One, two, three, four. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. And where have all the flowers gone? Young girls pick them, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn? Where have all the young girls gone? Long time passing. Where have all the young girls gone? Long time ago. Where have all the young girls gone? Gone to young men. Everyone, when will they ever learn? When will they ever learn? And where have all the young men gone? Long time passing. And where have all the young men gone? Long time ago. Where have all the young men gone? Gone for soldiers, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn? Where have all the soldiers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the soldiers gone? A long time ago. Where have all the soldiers gone? Gone to graveyards, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn? And where have all the graveyards gone? Long time passing. Where have all the graveyards gone? Long time ago. And where have all the graveyards gone? Gone to flowers, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn?
Nicely done for this hour of the morning, gentlemen. Nicely done indeed.
Thanks, Pete.
John Stewart and Nick Reynolds on Mixed Bag this morning. When did you two gentlemen first lay eyes on one another?
The trio was playing at the Coconut Grove, the big nightclub in, what's the name of the hotel?
During the Civil War.
Yeah, during the Civil War.
Actually, Nick doesn't remember the first time. It was at the L.A. County Fair. I was on a little label called R1 Records that was owned by Marty Melcher. And on the label was Jan and Arnie before Jan and Dean.
Right.
And I had a record deal to do a rock and roll album, and I was writing folk music at the time. And it was the L.A. County Fair, and on the show was Ritchie Valens, the Teddy Bears, the Champs, Johnny Cash, and the Kingston Trio. And I went down to meet them there and started hanging around the concerts after that, hanging around backstage. I was one of those guys who hangs around and would play them songs. But the first time they remember is when it was at the Coconut Grove.
We're rehearsing for an album, and in walks Johnny, this tall, straggly, you know, kid. How old were you then, John?
18. 18. 19.
And we were playing the big rooms, and Johnny walks in, and he had two songs he wanted to play for us. He probably had more. I don't know. He's always got a whole bunch of songs. One of them was called Green Grasses, and the other was called Molly D, and we needed some material for the album we were working on, so we immediately said, all right, these songs would be fine. And we, you know, sat around and rehearsed and talked, and he showed us the tunes and sang us the tunes and gave us some lyrics, and that was the beginning of it.
Oh, at the time when they said, God, we'd really like to do these songs, and I was just absolutely floored, and they said, do you have the publishing on these? And I said, what's publishing? That's the three guys went, oh, Frank.
We learned the hard way what publishing was.
Instant education in the ways of the music business.
What's publishing?
I see.
When we did the first album, none of us knew what publishing or writers meant. Mm-hmm. It took about 4 days to do the first album, the Red Album, Kingston Trio. And when it came to the end of it, our producer, Voyle Gilmore, and some other sort of men in business suits who were sitting around towards the end of the album. We were just kids out of San Francisco. They said, now, who are the writers on some of these songs, and do you have anybody handling your publishing? We said, huh? And we never knew what selling a record meant or how much we were going to get or anything. I never saw any contracts. And they said, well, Capitol has this marvelous company. We'll publish the songs for you. We'd be glad to, you know, take away the paperwork from, you know, you don't need all that trouble. And the publishing, he said, on the public domain, the tunes, we'll research them and see if they're public domain and put, I said, well, I don't want, you know, I don't care, but let's put it all in Dave's name, you know, because we were doing a lot of the arrangements together, but Dave was handling a lot of the arrangements at the time.
Was he a leader by default?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, Bobby and I were way too busy having way too much fun. And David was the most knowledgeable, and there was no elected leader, but he did a lot of the arrangements. And, well, we all did the arrangements and wrote some lyrics, some new lyrics for things, but we had no idea what writers and publishing was about.
Where were the seeds for the trio planted, Nick?
Oh, all differently. Personally, my family... My father played a great guitar, and we sat around and sang old barbershop things, all the old tunes from the 20s and 30s and 40s. But my first interest in folk music, I think, probably came from Burl Ives. I had the Burl Ives tape and knew all the songs. I'd play them on the ukulele. Then the magic of the Weavers. I was hanging around in San Francisco a little bit when I was in college, so I saw Stan Wilson at the Old Hungry Eye. It just mesmerized me. The Weavers just killed me. I've only seen them once in public when I was in college. I went up to San Francisco and saw them. Killed me, and kill me to this day, the greatest group of all time. Sure. Then along came the Gateway Singers, who I had some friends in that. They were playing at the Hungry Eye, and they were dynamic and almost equal to the Weavers as far as dynamics and arrangements. They had some marvelous singers in it.
Was there a grand scheme for the trio, or did it evolve more naturally?
It evolved very naturally. When we sat down, after we started becoming fairly popular in the nightclub business in San Francisco, we were playing a little club called the Purple Onion, and we were packing it every night. You know, we're sort of the new fair-haired boys of San Francisco, and when that happens, you become sort of a cult thing. This is before recordings or anything. It was a small club. But then we started making a little bit of a plan as far as what we were going to try and do. And what is this going to be an all-out effort, or is this just going to be for fun and go back to the real world later on? We decided to make it a real career, and we made some decisions like, you know, the name Kingston Trio, and we didn't want to get into the political end of it too much because we'd just seen and witnessed what had happened to the Weavers. And so we kind of took a middle-of-the-road attitude, professionally-wise. We didn't, you know, at that point it was real touchy. There was nobody making a living, hardly, at doing songs of, you know, political content, etc. Political or civil rights or anything like that. We wanted to kind of not stir up a lot of waves.
The name was chosen because?
We had to have a name, and we were doing a lot of Harry Belafonte's things at the time with conga drum and stuff. So we took Kingston Town, Kingston, Jamaica, Ivy League. We were wearing the striped shirts and, you know, sort of Ivy League pants, etc. Kingston just came out of a little, you know, 20-minute meeting with our manager, and we said, yeah, okay, it's the Kingston Trio.
John, I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, but I want to ask you first, why the group had such an impact. Why do you think the trio had such an impact?
When music came along and changed the lives of a lot of us, when music was just there as background, as wallpaper in the 50s, and Elvis Presley came out of nowhere and changed our synapse and our brains forever, and music became part of our identity, there was a big lapse there when Elvis went in the army and the Frankie Avalon Fabian era came along. And we were all at that point going into college, and rock and roll at that point had become sort of a joke. And along comes this group having all this fun, singing about heroic, romantic things, and singing songs that were fun to sing, like rock and roll, easy to play like rock and roll, and songs that had magic and mystery and humor in them. And it was a situation that rock and roll had that everyone who heard it felt that, given a chance, they could do that too. Where the Weavers, I had heard, and I remember being impressed of how great they were. I heard the trio and went, they're great, and I can do that.
Hmm.
And I think that is one of the great magic elements that the trio had that opened folk music up to America and to a large part of the world. If it wasn't for the Kingston Trio, I really have serious doubts if the village scene would have ever happened in that way.
Nick, you agree?
Yeah, I think Pete Seeger said it, that it was the time of the do-it-yourself after, you know, at that time in history, everything was do-it-yourself. And the trio was a perfect medium for the do-it-yourself. People would watch us on stage, and you could actually see them turning to each other saying, I could do that. He's only playing two chords, right? He's only playing two chords and singing a third. I can do that.
Speaking of two chords, you mentioned earlier that you have a pared-down two-chord version of one of the trio's biggest hits.
I do. It's not really pared down. It's pared down vocally because I've been doing it on the show with Johnny just as a solo. And there never were more than two chords.
Want to take a stab?
Sure. Hang down your head, Tom. Dooley, hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom. Dooley, poor boy, you're bound to die. Met her on the mountain, there I took her life. Met her on the mountain, stabbed her with my knife. Hang down your head, Tom. Dooley, hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom. Dooley, poor boy, you're bound to die. This time tomorrow, reckon where I'll be. If it hadn't been for Grayson, I'd have been in Tennessee. Hang down your head, Tom. Dooley, hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom. Dooley, poor boy, you're bound to die. This time tomorrow, reckon where I'll be. Down in some lonesome valley, hanging from a white oak tree. Hang down your head, Tom. Dooley, hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom. Dooley, poor boy, you're bound to die. Poor boy, you're bound to die. Poor boy, you're bound to die. A poor boy, you're bound to die.
Why was that such an enormous hit?
I'll never know. I really don't know. There was a spoken introduction. Throughout history, there have been many songs written about the Eternal Triangle, etc.
Mm-hmm.
At first, Capitol didn't know whether to leave that on the single. It was on the album. But when Tom Dooley became, they took it off the album 8 months after the album was released due to pressure from disc jockeys around the country and stuff. They were going to take the introduction off of that, but it was kind of a catch thing, I think, that spoken introduction. There was nothing like it, and the disc jockeys liked it a lot. You know, they could ease into it, this little announcement about the song.
You were at the center of the storm, Nick. How did success impact on the trio?
Well, it was so, it was like a cyclone, you know. Everybody's talked about success. Here we were having a great time, you know, making sort of a living in San Francisco, $60 a week or something. We were making it, the Purple Onion apiece. And to ride the roller coaster is a trip higher than I've ever taken, and I've taken a few.
John, you were laughing. How come?
That it is such a wicked mistress, success, and it is success earned by other people is not a train ride that really can be taken by other people. When I became a member of the trio, and going from being a fan and being a songwriter and seeing them having all this fun on stage and going, I'm going to be a member of the Kingston Trio now, and I'm going to be having all that fun. And the first day I put on the striped shirt and realized there was no magic in the shirt, and there was still me up there. And
some
I
odors.
Wasn't having that fun, you know, and they were having the fun. And it was their success. It was something that they had built, and it was something they had earned, and it was... It does strange things. Very few people survive success. Going through the 60s and the people I've known that are dead and have gone through great trials and come out all right, like John Phillips, and people have seen enormous success, it gets you one way or the other. I've seen very few people survive it, and yet it's the most coveted item on the planet, yeah. I think.
Dave Gard left after... number of successful years.
About 3 years.
Did you consider that it was over at that point, or were you ready right away to continue?
Well, I didn't consider that it was over because this was sort of at the height of the first real success. So, it felt, it was kind of a scary period. We had a lot of bookings and a lot of engagements, TV shows and things. I didn't know where the other magic was coming, because David was certainly a magical member. He had other things he wanted to do, so he left. And we only talked to two or three people, but John was already singing in a group called the Cumberland Three. We'd known him for a long time, and he was a friend. And there was some question, I think, John, about whether you could even get out of the Cumberland Three, wasn't it? You guys were being managed by Frank, too, and... I never really asked, but anyway, John,
no, Frank,
there was no audition or anything.
Oh, there was an audition.
Well, I don't remember it. I blacked
very
it out.
Heavy audition.
Kind of, I know
I
we
remember
auditioned.
The audition.
I don't remember
clearly.
It at all.
In Bobby's basement with all these gold albums on the wall.
Oh, okay.
Not too intimidating, huh, Pete?
They made it tough for you.
No.
There were three people. There was myself and Travis Edmondson from Bud and Travis, and a guy named Chip Douglas, who later went on to be MFQ and produced Linda Ronstadt and the Monkees and
Turtles for
the
a
Turtles,
while.
Yeah. And he has never forgiven me for that. he got to be Dave Gard and I didn't. Right, vice versa.
That's right. Very funny. That's very funny. Now, your generation of the trio went from about 61 to 67.
Right.
Good
right.
Half a dozen years. Did you both leave at the same time?
Yes, we
exactly
did.
The same time.
What put it to rest?
We were very successful and been traveling lots of days. It wasn't like the days today where you do 8 big forum kind of deals across the... country, and that's the tour, and you make millions of dollars, et cetera. We had to work about 300 plus days a year in order to keep the nut together and make the money in those days, traveling continually. I had a wife and a young son living in San Francisco, and it was tough. So John and I had gotten really close, and I could see the torment in him about being a replacement and being treated that way by management, et cetera. Also, he saw all of his friends, and my friends too at the time, but he was much closer, being the songwriter poet that he is. He wanted to do something on his own. His own brother was having a hit record, you know, by himself or with the Wee Five. And John Phillips, who had written songs with John and were good friends, was going on with the Mamas and the Papas. John wanted it, as far as, you know, our conversations, wanted to strike out on his own. And I was tired of the road after 9 years, so we went to our manager, and I couldn't do it without John. I mean, I couldn't, wouldn't be any more replacement for me. I didn't need to do it anymore financially and or emotionally. I'd run the whole gamut. Show business is not my life, you know. I wanted to get back to the country and try and patch things up with my family. My son I'd hardly ever seen. So we went to our manager. He said, work, you know, and the accountant said, work one more year real hard, and then that would be, you know, that would give you the vehicle to leave with gracefully. Bobby wanted to keep it together. But it was a decision we made in 66, I guess. So we worked the following year almost every day, you know, all kinds of jobs, funny ones and some great ones and some weird ones. And in the summer of 67, we played The Last Engagement at the Hungry Eye, 2 weeks, which we recorded, which has never been released. I've got the tapes. But it was all very amicable, and it was planned in advance.
Nick, what did you do in those 20 years?
Well, I had a great time, for one thing. I was raised on a ranch in Southern California most of my life, my younger years, and I've always... I remember the first time I came to New York, we played the Village Vanguard, and with Ben Webster and Stan Getz and all these people. It was an oddball booking, but it was great. It worked out. The trio always had a very good relationship with jazz for some reason. We're certainly not jazz musicians. You know, as I say, two chords, that's it. But we, when we traveled and did concerts, we lots of times would have groups, Jerry Mulligan, Stan Getz. So I wanted to get, I remember going back to my hotel room in New York the first time and saying, oh boy, I love this, but what I really want to do is go back to the country someday, if this will enable me to do that. So I moved up to Oregon in 67, had a little two-room cabin, and on this beautiful river, I learned how to cut wood, I learned how to take care of myself, fix the plumbing, do all the things that I'd never done in my life, because there's no plumber to call up there. I eventually bought a ranch next door. And my first wife went down the road, cabin fever, and my son and I stayed up there. I remarried several years later to a beautiful girl who's, you know, just my real life now is this, just starting doing this again, but primarily staying with my family. I've got 3 kids from 5 to 13, and they're in real good schools now. But up there I was a cattle rancher and a fisherman and a father, for the first time, which is something that I really want to do in this gorgeous part of the world, living in paradise, but a rainy paradise. And after 20 years, it was time to move back, and John and I had lots of conversations, and he said, come on down, we'll sing together, right?
Yeah. I meant to ask you earlier, for a time there, the Kingston Trio was the cream of Capitol Records.
Absolutely.
Absolute number one group. Then all of a sudden, about 1964 or so, along came the Beatles.
Oh, boy. Yeah, and rightfully so, you know. Well, out, you know, when something like that comes along, which is the natural phenomenon, it was and should be and will be historically the greatest, you know, group of all time, popular group as far as I'm concerned.
Did you feel pushed aside?
Yeah, but I didn't have any animosity. It was just kind of like... this is the way history goes down. We never really thought it was going to last forever, you know, or last that long. Or we never even thought when we started out there was anything was going to happen other than what we were doing. You know, $60 a week, I'd do that the rest of my life, you know.
It was chilling, though. We went to England and opened a London Hilton over there that brought a lot of acts from around the world. And we were big fans of the Springfields, which was really the first folk rock group with Dusty Springfield and her brother Tom. And they were having an awards concert over there. And we went to see the Springfields. And the most promising new group was the Beatles. And I remember we saw the Beatles. And
oh, yeah.
Nick and
yeah.
I both went, that's it. Once that hits America, it's all over with. And within 2 months, I Want to Hold Your Hand came out. And when we, the last show at the Hungry Eye we did, showed slides of the trio over the years.
Before the show.
And played Sgt. Pepper.
Ah.
I mean, it was, we knew, everybody knew at that point when the Beatles hit, that was it.
Yeah.
You know, the era had begun. And the very last show at the Hungry Eye, we always closed with Where Have All the Flowers Gone, Scotch and Soda, which was a Bob Shane solo, and Saints Go Marching In. And it was all planned out, but when Bobby went to do Scotch and Soda, Nick and I went out to the dressing room door and got in our cars and drove off and went down to the Monterey Pop Festival and watched Jimi Hendrix burn his guitar. Right.
Pauly Simon had to get me in backstage. He saw me, Nick, I'd only met him once in an airport, but we were contemporaries. And so there I see little Paul, and I was trying to get him backstage. And the trio, you know, down at the Monterey Pop Festival with the Mamas and Papas, Scott McKenzie.
Shopland.
Yeah, Scott McKenzie in his garments, you know.
Right.
Yeah, if you're going to see, you know. So we're down there. Paul said, God, get in back here and get in on some of this free food. I said, God, I'd love to, man. So I owe Paul the debt, besides his music, you know, that I've loved for years, to forgetting him in backstage.
At Monterey, wow. John, it's always a pleasure to welcome you to Nick's Bag. And Nick, finally to meet you after all these years.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
There's another trio song that you've reworked as a duo. Do you think we can close out with that one?
Sure. Why not?
Written by Hoyt Axton and another fella I could never remember his name. Well, some people say I'm a no count, and others say I'm no good. But I'm just a natural born traveling man, doing what I think I should. Oh yeah, doing what I think I should. When I was a little baby, my mama said, hey son, travel where you will, grow to be a man, sing what must be sung, poor boy, sing what must be sung. And I don't give a damn about a greenback dollar, spend it as fast as I can. For a wailing song and a good guitar, yeah, the only thing that I understand, poor boy, the only thing that I understand. Now that I am a grown man, I've traveled here and there, and I've learned that a bottle of brandy and a song, the only ones who ever care. Oh yeah, they're the only ones who ever care. And I don't give a damn about a greenback dollar, spend it as fast as I can. For a wailing song and a good guitar, yeah, the only thing that I understand, oh boy, the only thing that I understand, oh yeah. Some people say I'm a no count, others say I'm no good, I'm just a natural born traveling man, doing what I think I should, oh yeah. Doing what I think I should. And I don't give a damn about a greenback dollar, and I spend it as fast as I can. For a wailing song and a good guitar, yeah, the only thing that I understand, poor boy, the only thing that I understand. Sending out an SOS, sending out an SOS, sending out an SOS, sending out an SOS. Ooh.